Radio Influence. The future is now.
He got him in the white trunks. He heard him.
That's beautiful.
Oh, God.
That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he forced the top.
Wow.
And here's the submission. And it's all over. It's
nice.
All over. First round knockout.
Big
is how Rich Franklin retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen, happened.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
UFC Fight Night 110 took place on Sunday morning in Auckland, New Zealand. Saturday night here in the United States, it was headlined by Mark Hunt scoring a fourth round TKO victory over Derek Lewis. And that was one of four knockout victories on the main card. Also, Derek Brunson, Dan Hooker, and Kutalabe all scoring stoppage victories there. We're going to recap this fight card here on this episode of the MMA Report post-fight podcast on Radio Influence. Of course, we are brought to you by Fight TV. Live stream free and premium MMA, pro wrestling, and boxing live on your phone or TV. Get a front row seat to live wrestling, MMA, and boxing action anytime, anyplace. Get Fight free and see what's streaming now for you. You can download the Fight app by going to Fight, FITE.TV /radio influence/. Once again, that is Fight, FITE.TV /radio influence/. And that link is also available on radioinfluence.com. Daniel, how's it going, man?
It's going good. I really enjoyed the card last night. It was very much reminiscent of my favorite Strikeforce cards. It was just a moving the chains type of event, was it not, Jason? I don't know if you saw this one live, but I do think the best viewing of this event had to have been with the remote control in your hand to skip through all the commercials and just breeze through this like phenomenal main card of quick finishes.
On Saturday night, I went out to our local soccer team here at Tampa Bay Rowdies and got home about midway through the first fight on the main card and watched the main card live. But, you know, here on Sunday morning when we're recording this podcast, I went back and watched the preliminary card. And, you know, look, you had some fights that had some dynamic knockouts, which does make me wonder, because of the fact of there was more time between the weigh-ins and the fights actually starting, which apparently is about approximately 44 hours, it makes me wonder, because of the amount of additional time that these fighters did have to rehydrate, get their bodies where they need to be from their weight cuts, did that ultimately play a role in why we saw the fights go down this way?
That's a very interesting question, and it's just literally impossible for us to answer with such a small sample size of just one fight card. But it's one to keep in mind every time we have these longer type distances between weigh-ins and fight night. I'm assuming, Jason, the reason why there was such a long delay between the weigh-in and the fight card was simply due to the fact that the fight night card started at like 7 a.m. Was that why there was such a long layoff between the weigh-ins and the fight night?
I'm sure that definitely the time difference, which I think is like 15, 16 hours from here, East Coast in the United States. It's I know for the fighters going over there, it was a 15-hour flight from the United States. I mean, I've never been on a flight that long. I've been on a flight for 7 hours, as long as flight I've ever been on, which I can't imagine being on a flight for 15 hours.
Yeah, you could probably watch 3.5 Star Wars movies, I think, on that flight, which is just, I don't know what you do if you're a fighter. I don't know if you just spend the entire time resting, watching fight tape, or catching up with your pop culture. Like, if you were a big time UFC fighter, Jason, on a flight from Las Vegas to New Zealand, how do you think you would spend your time?
I'm literally downloading whatever new show is on Netflix, and I'm just binge watching the whole season on the flight.
And then you're going to wonder why you lost afterwards.
I mean, that's because look, a guilty pleasure. Look, new season of House of Cards came on Netflix, what, you know, a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago. It took me 3 days to get through it.
That's absolutely sad, because I believe there are, what, 10 episodes on that?
Yeah, I think at one point I watched 5 episodes in a row.
It's a real hard thing to stop when you end the Netflix episode and it gives you about 5 seconds to stop your computer before the new one.
You know, the thing, Netflix to me has ruined regular television. you know, because like one of the shows that I watched when it was originally around was Prison Break. So the new they did a new season of Prison Break this year, and I found myself like I waited to have the DVR have about 4 episodes recorded before I started watching it. Like Netflix truly has ruined the way I watch television.
And you know what? It does really control the way pop culture works. I do wonder if the UFC has missed some type of opportunity. I don't know if they've tried to do this, of trying to sell a show to Netflix.
There was some rumors that actually Dana White's looking for a fight show is going to go on Netflix.
Oh, that's going to really be the show to get the... You don't need a dude looking for a fight, all right?
If they did not have the... if they did not have UFC Fight Pass, I think that Tuesday night Dana White Contender Series would probably be something... would make sense for Netflix, because you do hear where Netflix does want to get into live programming.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it is difficult to juggle both things when you have your own Fight Pass, or if you're the WWE, your own WWE Network, and then sell something to another similar enterprise. I'm just saying, like, when it comes to getting fans to become casual people or that aren't aware of MMA to become fans of the sport, you want to put your product in places where the casual people are. And if you can somehow sell some type of show to Netflix that they will feel confident enough to market on their front page for a single day, much like they do with every stand-up special, I don't know what that show is. It's not looking for a fight, as much as I love Dean Thomas and Matt Serra. But whatever it is, that to me is how you actually get people to watch it. And I don't even know if it's a live event, just because that to me doesn't have the wide range of a potential net to throw in the ocean and pick up, you know, 250,000 new fans. So that's just I don't know what the idea would be. It would have to be something similar to The Ultimate Fighter.
I was just thinking, you remember that documentary they did, what was it, prior to, was it UFC 200? It was like, kind of where the UFC had come from, you know, day one to where it was now. I want to say I'm trying to remember when they did it. I think it was for the 20-year anniversary, whenever that was. To me, that would be the type of show I think you would put on Netflix. There is some MMA program. I watched the documentary The Hurt Business on Netflix probably, I don't know, 3-4 months ago. That was a good one. There is MMA programming on there, but is it being featured by Netflix? Most likely not. I mean, look, I'm a huge Netflix guy. I watched pretty much that's outside of, you know, live sporting events. I would say that's probably 75% of how I view television.
I get it. You like to Netflix and chill.
No comment. But overall, I mean, I was entertained with this card. It was a card that obviously had some dynamic finishes. One of the things, we haven't done this in a while, kind of our I think we labeled this our top 3 stars or those defining moments. And there's so many defining moments when you look at this fight card. But I got to point to Ben Wynn first off, because who saw that coming?
Not us, man. I think we both expected a close fight. And Brian Stann did a nice job of establishing Tim Elliott's credibility after the fight, where he said Tim Elliott was an 8th-ranked flyweight, but he was better than that. And that's how I thought Tim Elliott was as well. This is a fighter who is literally game against everybody from DJ downwards. He kind of fights up or down to his competition, established himself as a top 5 fighter. And within 49 seconds for Ben Wynn, this was more than just one single punch. This was every single strike in this fight for Ben Wynn landed accurately. And then when there was a grappling exchange, Wynn dominated it, got his back, maintained that position, and locked down the submission. Every aspect of this fight, Ben Wynn dominated, and for him to go out there and tap out a guy who I think we both understand is like a high-level grappler in Tim Elliott, a guy who is just absolutely game and hard to finish. Ben Wynn, he's my star of the night as well, Jason. He did the most to improve his stock heading out of this card. You kind of get jazzed up and excited about whatever his next potential matchup is. And if he pieces together this finish with another finish in his next fight or a dominant win, he's going to have so much momentum heading upwards. I mean, more momentum than even, you know, I would almost say Ben Wynn is in a position to get a title shot with one more victory if it's kind of similar to this one.
You know, and we do call out fighters when they don't say what they want next. But I love what Ben Wynn had to say, because he's sitting there and he's just being honest, like, I don't know what the future of my division is. And you know, obviously the you know, Dana White had some more you know, comments about, you know, hey, maybe we've been talking about this getting rid of flyweight division for 3 years, da 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 da. Which, if you're a 125 pound fighter, you feel very uncomfortable with where you're at. But when you look at where Ben Wynn is at, he came in this ranked number 12 heading into this fight. But you know, clearly, you know, Tim Elliott was number 8. Ben Wynn deserves to be in the top 10, and there's some matchups that are upcoming. You know, you look at that Sergio Pettis, Bram Moreno fight that is coming up, that depending on what happens with DJ, I think that would be a number one type contender fight. You know, obviously you have Ray Bourque sitting there. You know, so I think if you're Ben Wynn, I mean, he's got to be getting somebody, I think, probably in that 3 to 6 range.
I don't know whatever it is, but whatever it is I'm like really excited. And it does make me absolutely disappointed that there's any type of discussion of disbanding this division. Because I tell you what, there are a few divisions, I think. You look at the 14th best fighter, and they stack up anywhere close to Alexander Pantoja. Like, that guy is awesome. Smolka at 13 is awesome. All these fighters, it's like a really deep division. It doesn't really draw, obviously. Like, Demetrius Johnson has done like 100,000 buy rates for a couple of the events, like against Bagatinov and against, I think, was it Horiguchi? That one was also like awful.
Yeah.
So he's done bad buy rates, don't get me wrong, but the depth of this division is just, it's awesome. And the fighters, a lot of them are incredibly exciting. So for Dana to say, like, they've been talking about disbanding this division for 3 years, it's like, are you kidding me? Are you telling me that you made this division on September 2012, or you crowned a champion on that night? That's when you crowned it, and you were already talking about disbanding it in June 2014. Like, that's outrageous. And obviously, in that same soundbite, didn't he say that Connor was the best pound for pound, despite the fact that he literally said DJ was on like April of this year?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's like, do you forget what you said 2 months ago? And it's just like, and Dana has become this very much of this these power people that, when they don't like something that gets reported, they love to just call it fake news. When it's something that doesn't go along with their narrative, it's fake news. And it's just, I think at the end of the day, in Demetrius Johnson's situation, you offer Demetrius Johnson enough money, I think he's fighting TJ Dillashaw.
So here's one thing I really wanted to mention about Demetrius Johnson. And then we can get back to the poor Ben Wynn, who was just awesome in this fight. I just wanted to mention this. So, like, this whole Demetrius Johnson, Dana White situation to me is kind of infuriating, but kind of genius. Okay, it's kind of infuriating because Demetrius Johnson and Dana White are both not really taking responsibility for marketing Demetrius Johnson. Demetrius Johnson should get himself over. It's his own responsibility to get himself over, and he's blaming the UFC for not getting him over, but he has a good reason to, because the UFC is his promoter, and the UFC is blaming DJ for not getting over, but it's the UFC's job to get their own fighters over. So they each kind of take their own responsibility to get that man over and every other high-level fighter over. But here is the genius aspect of what's going on, Jason, about what's actually happening here. Here's my hashtag woke theory. This may be getting Demetrius Johnson over. Like, we have been talking about Demetrius Johnson daily for the past couple of weeks. So this little ploy between Dana White versus Demetrius Johnson could, in the long run, make Demetrius Johnson some type of pay-per-view draw. Like, don't discount the fact that all this press is a good thing for DJ when he does, in fact, fight TJ Dillashaw. And I would also not be surprised if, when he does fight Dillashaw, that's a pay-per-view that does do 200,000 pay-per-view buys compared to, what, like 120,000 against Borg?
To me, at the end of the day, in terms of the marketing of fighters, it's a two-way street. You know, the UFC has to do their job, and the fighter has to do their job as well. The fighter just can't sit back and just think that, oh, because you're fighting the UFC, it's going to go out there. I mean, I think that you have to sit back and say the UFC has to do a better job of promoting fighters. I mean, let's just look at this card, you know, that happened last night. It's a fight card that I don't think the UFC did a proper job of promoting it. I think they have done a better job of promoting the fight that's coming up on Saturday morning from Singapore. And I think the reason for that is because it's on their streaming service. And it's not, I don't know if the card in Singapore gets as much publicity and promoted as much by the UFC if it's on FS1. I mean, they promoted it during the pay-per-view last weekend. You did not see a promotion for this Fight Night card. So I think that there's got to be. But to me, it's both sides of the equation. And, you know, for a guy like Ben Wynn, how do you get people interested in the story of you? I mean, I had a chance to talk to him before it. I thought it was, you know, interesting the fact of, you know, this is a guy that, you know, moved from the United States to Australia. How his wrestling and jiu-jitsu coach worked with the Crocodile Hunter Steve Irwin in the zoo there in Australia. So, I mean, I think there's a little bit of an interesting story there, because I think in Ben Wynn's case, when people think of his name, I think for the most part, they likely think about that viral video. And, you know, kind of like, I think the way people always look at Alima Leigh McFarlane as, oh, that is a fighter that beat up the soccer mom, or they look at Dom Reyes, who just got signed by the UFC, as, hey, he's the guy that head kicked that dude when he acted like he wasn't hurt, you know. And but I think it's, you know, there's got to be more to that fighter. And for a guy like Ben Wynn, I mean, clearly one of the best 125 pounders in the world. And as I look at the rankings and what makes sense for him, of course, Joseph Benavidez is out with the ACL injury. Of course, initially he was supposed to fight Joseph Benavidez on this card. Henry Cejudo's got a fight coming up against Wilson Hayes, so that knocks him out. Ray Borg, who knows what ends up happening with Ray Borg, and of course that whole Demetrius Johnson situation. And then at number five, Jussier Formiga. To me, on the outside looking in, and Formiga doesn't have a fight book as far as I know, Formiga, Ben Wynn, I think, is a fight that makes a lot of sense for Ben next.
Yeah, that he appears to be the one guy available above him in the rankings that would be a sweet fight. And the moral of the story for Ben Wynn's next fight is sometimes you give a guy a fighter below him in the rankings. I would not be surprised if, you know, Mark Hunt gets someone under him. But for Ben Wynn, he certainly deserves a big-time improvement on his opponent caliber from his own specific ranking of, like, number 12 in the division. So Formiga's up there. Obviously, we had another flyweight and John Moraga compete on the event. But for me, having watched this performance, it was just a big-time catapult for Ben Wynn, where he really deserves to be in a situation where if he's not one fight away, he's two fights away from a title shot, because there is some distance where he is now from Demetrius Johnson. But in his favor, again, is the uniqueness of him not having challenged for a title quite yet, is how dynamite this performance was, is the fact that he does have a viral video in his history, which it's important to use that as fuel to get yourself notoriety. And I mean, for him to go, and if people are listening to this and don't remember, Ben Wynn's the guy who went toe-to-toe with the guy with the face tattoos, who looks like a, you know, somebody that gets eliminated on the second episode of The Ultimate Fighter, and he gets in his face or whatever, and he knocks him out brutally. So that's the fight I would look forward to. The dream matchup for me is like matching up Ben Wynn against a super aggressive striker. Like, I would love to see down the line one day Ben Wynn versus Pettis, or more importantly, actually, Brandon Moreno would just be an awesome fight down the line. But moving forward, Formiga is the right matchup, I would say. And great, a lot of energy out of his post-fight interview, by the way. He was just a joy to listen to. Great personality. I love how both him and his wife fought in back-to-back days. I think she was boxing, and then she won, and then the pressure was on him to win against maybe a more higher caliber of opponent. So a lot of pressure there to beat Tim Elliott, but he got it done. And I'm sure him and his wife, April Adams, I believe is her name, they can go and celebrate by eating buffalo wings or whatever.
I mean, he just, that post-fight interview just made him so relatable to the common person out there. And I think that's what ultimately fighters have to do, is how do you make yourself to where kind of, you know, fans understand. And of course, you know, he mentioned that, you know, he was, they asked him in his post-fight scrum after how he was going to celebrate this, and said that planned to eat a lot of food, drink a lot of beer, and said that pizza is his thing. Pizza is kind of his cheat meal, which I'm all down for some good pizza.
Yeah, it's not the most unique thing in the world, but it is absolutely delicious. Where is Ben Wynn stay out of? Where does he train?
He's in Australia. He's in Australia.
I do wonder how good Australian pizza is. I bet it's great. I do wonder what the delicacies are in Australia. That is, to me, like the coolest thing about, you know, if I'm somebody that works for the UFC, I would absolutely raise my hand up to travel around the world and try out different cuisines around the world. I know you're a big NFL guy, but you have not traveled to Australia until they make a team there in 10 years. But
I mean, the only place I've gone internationally in the NFL would be London. So, and I've been to London now 3 times. I went right after I got out of high school for 2 weeks, and you know, I've been over there now twice. You know, 2 other times, and you know, it's you know, been there, done that. You know.
Okay, way to be real dismissive against London. I mean,
I the first time I went there, I had a good time. I mean, you do all the touristy things, but you know, kind of by the time you get there the third time, you've kind of done everything, you know. You know, and then it just becomes a business trip at the end of the day. But there's definitely parts of the world that I'd love to go to,
like Sunderland, England.
Sure.
You can hang out with Ross Pearson and watch Sunderland Football Club. You know,
yeah.
Or I got one. Here's where you should go, so you can figure out where the hell it is, because I don't know where it is. Moldova, and hang out with Kutalaba.
You know, look, if you know, you're going to you know, he had a very interesting start of that fight as he's getting his name announced and getting in his opponent's face. But yeah, we'll get into that. But I do want to mention, you mentioned about John Moraga while we're talking about the flyweights. A great performance by him. You know, just a complete dominating performance by John Moraga. And you know, he talked about heading into this fight that you know, he knew his back was against the wall, even thought that, you know, it was, you know, thought that he might have been able to get, was going to get released prior to the getting this fight, but gets his first win since December 13th of 2014. And you know, this is a guy that you forget that when you look at his losses in the UFC, you know, three of his losses in the UFC are really to the top three guys in this division. Now, one of those fighters is no longer at 125. He's at 135 in John Dotson. But, you know, he lost to Demetrius Johnson, Joe Benavidez, his other losses in the UFC. Split decision against Matthias Nicolai, and then a unanimous decision loss against Sergio Pettis. But this is a guy that obviously just, what can you say, just a dominating performance.
Yeah, for every question that Ashkin Mokhtarian had, John Moraga had an answer. And there is some sense of relief as a viewer of the sport when you see a fighter struggle as much as Moraga has to get a victory, for him to finally break that losing streak, because the losing streak was to high quality fighters. He, in his lead up to getting a fight against Demetrius Johnson, with the way he finished his opponents, Carriasso and Ulysses Gomez Pryor, he had already put himself in a position where you kind of respected his place in the division. He really was lost. And this was a fight where there was so much to lose against a debuting fighter in Mokhtarian. And you never know what your performance is going to be like. And this was just awesome. This was just a return to form for John Moraga. And he looked really dynamite to me on the feet. His counters on the grappling exchange, there really wasn't a whole lot for Mokhtarian to do consistently in score points, and this was just a dominant performance out of John Moraga. I hope for him that he doesn't shoot up the rankings fight-wise. Like, his next fight is something close to earth, just given, you know, losing 3 in a row to top fighters and Pettis, Benavidez, Nicolo. So I don't know what's necessarily next for John Moraga, but this was just a reminder that he still is a top 12 type flyweight.
You know, let me get your thoughts on this. I kind of feel like the UFC should have done 4 performance of the night bonuses as opposed to 2 performance of the nights in the fight of the night, which the fight of the night bonus winner was Mark Hunt and Derek Lewis. The performance of the night bonuses were Dan Hooker and Ben Wynn. You feel bad for Derek Brunson and Vince Michel and even Kutalabe, because I think they all had the very good cases for performance of the night bonus.
They should have done 4 performance of the night bonuses. Maybe. I mean, maybe the Derek Lewis thing was like a thank you for your career or whatnot, but like, that fight was not a fight of the night, man. That fight was sad in rounds 3 and 4. And Derek Brunson, I mean, that dude went out there, finished a fight in a single punch, and then Vince Pichel came back from hell. What a great, great knockout from him. I totally agree with you. Either those two or Kutalaba did so much in their fights in so little time, that this was the time where, I believe it was a couple years ago, that they established the protocol that they could do 4 performance of the nights, I think. So this was the time to break open that bottle and do it, because those guys did it. I mean, the most cringeworthy thing to me was in his post-fight interview, when you deserve a performance of the night, clearly, and you call for it, and it's not that bad, but if you're Alexander Volkanovski, bro, he called for a performance the night after his decision win. There was no chance in hell that he was going to win that. Like,
this would be the interesting thing. How many performance of the night bonuses have come from a fighter winning a decision?
That wasn't in the main event.
Correct, yeah.
Or a title fight. That's a great question.
It's got to be a low number.
It's got to be zero, I think.
I would think there's got to be maybe a couple, but I think in terms of percentage, we could probably say less than 10%.
100%. Like, I literally think it might be zero, dude. Like, who – you would have to – what would you have to do? Win, like, 3 10-8 rounds or something like that? Like, I don't – and we're talking about performance of the night only, not fight of the night, where it's single-sided dominance and it's, like, a non-main event, co-main event type fight where it's not, like – you know what I'm saying? I don't know if next time we do a show, I'll actually look this up. I'll go through all of them and I'll double check because that's a great question. And again, I would not be surprised, Jason, if the answer is zero. Maybe there's been a couple of fight cards where there just hasn't been many finishes, like one or two, and that may be where it took place. But I would be shocked if it's more than 5%.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a very low number. Now, you mentioned about Derek Lewis, Mark Hunt. You know, Mark Hunt, I thought it was, you know, he went out there and did what he needed to do. I mean, we talked about it on the preview podcast about how is he going to close the gap on Derek Lewis. And of course, the big note after this fight was over, the fact of Derek Lewis, it sounds like retirement is in his future. Of course, when it comes to combat sports and a fighter mentions retirement, especially when that fighter is only 32 years old, you kind of you have your doubts on it. And, you know, he mentioned about this back injury. And, you know, of course, you know, even Brian Stann was kind of like, was it your leg or your back? And then I went back as someone who's dealt with back pain in his life. And I watched Derek Lewis and how he was moving his body. It was very clear to me that, yeah, he's got a back injury. You can see it in his posture, the way he was arching his back. I could definitely see that, yes, it was a back injury. You know, one of the questions we got in relation to Derek Lewis was, you know, and this comes from at Woodrow and Ed and A, is it possible Lewis is using this retirement talk for leverage for a new deal? He actually just signed a new contract, and he mentioned leading into this fight that he was very happy. But I don't know if you saw this. Travis Brown basically took his shot at Derek Lewis after it. Also, Francis Ngannou took his shot out there. And I think that ultimately this was probably not the ideal result for the UFC, because now you look at the UFC heavyweight division, and if Cain Velasquez is not ready to fight Stipe Miocic in the next 6 months, who's next? I mean, is it Verdum with a you know, dominant victory over Overeem? Are we talking about Francis Ngannou essentially skips everyone and gets right into that title matchup? I mean, you know, we even got a question from Brian Abraham saying, can Hunt get a title shot after this fight? I don't think Hunt gets a title matchup. You know, he mentioned about the fact that he would like to fight in Japan in September. And of course, you know, Mark Hunt is a guy who is, you know, 1-1 and won no contest in his last three fights, or 3-1 and won no contest, you know, since the end of 2015. I don't think he can get a win with the title matchup, but I don't think it's crazy to say that Mark Hunt is a win away from a title shot.
I would agree with that. He definitely is a win away, and he is the name out of all that you just mentioned that has to be the farthest away. So this does throw a wrench in the plans of the UFC, but seeing Cain Velasquez in the building, would not be shocked if we see him. It just works out, and he fights Stipe. Now, the problem is it's a two-step process for Cain Velasquez, where one, you sign the fight, and two, the fight actually happens. So It may be a situation for Mark Hunt where he could find himself getting a title shot as some type of injury replacement. So with the victory, he's in some position, but certainly not the first, second, or third position. Ngannou jumping to get a title shot without another win would be rough, but it could take place as well. To me, the way I would do the odds is just Velasquez, Verdum, Overeem winner, and then a Dos Santos Ngannou winner if you do that fight. Although another fight that you could just do, right, is Ngannou versus Mark Hunt. But Derek Lewis was the guy that the UFC, I think, was expecting to win this fight. He was the betting odds favorite. We both picked him to win this fight. And this was a rough one to watch, man, later on. It was really captivating in the beginning, but as you mentioned, that back injury is just brutal. It's like if your body is a house, I would say the back is the foundation of the house. You just literally cannot do anything like you used to if that's hampering you down. I mean, my mother has like a back injury and she's had it for years. Like, I don't think in my life I've ever seen her jog ever. That's how bad back injuries can be. And I don't know how bad Derek Lewis's back injury is. It certainly can't be as bad as my mother's, just because like he competed in an athletic event. My mom can't. But it's one where when he does talk about retirement, the back is something you absolutely must protect, because it's hard to get it back to where it once was. It's almost impossible, and it affects your daily life. So if that is like a significant issue for Derek Lewis, I would say hopefully he can just not put stress on that.
Yeah, I mean, you just wonder, is that something that, you know, he can have a surgery? And obviously any back, there's nothing minor when it comes to back, and I've had back injuries. You know, anyone who's had a back injury knows kind of what Derek Lewis is going through. But when you look at kind of what's, Mark Hunt mentioned Junior Dos Santos as he would like to have that rematch potentially in Japan. You know, this is kind of, and timing is everything in the sport. We know we've got Verdum and Overeem coming up next month at UFC 213. JDS versus Ngannou, JDS versus Hunt, Ngannou versus Hunt. All those matchups make sense, but I think it ultimately just comes down to how does timing and injuries kind of play into this. I think if Kane is next for Stipe, I could see Verdum Overeem winner against Ngannou, and then JDS versus Mark Hunt rematch. Which, I mean, look, sign me. The first fight was fun. I wouldn't mind seeing those two run it back again.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind that one as well. I would probably put that behind a potential Hunt-Ngannou fight, but if you do Ngannou versus that winner, that, I mean, JDS needs a dancing partner, and Mark Hunt, that fight was fun, and honestly, Mark Hunt looked better to me than he had in his last few fights. He just looked very disciplined, just consistently in this fight. He had his cardio put together real well heading into that fourth round, and he showcased discipline in Derek Lewis, because even though Derek Lewis, I mean, he just looked bad. Like, his footwork was just non-existent. Like, he was really eliminating his base and his movement, and he was tripping and whatnot. But even then, it was smart for Mark Hunt not to go ballistic, just because at the end of the day, Derek Lewis is like a movie guy who gets hit with multiple shots, but he still has the ability to take you out. He's kind of like the Terminator, where as handicapped as he may be with both his back and his conditioning, he still has the power to put any human being away, despite that single fact. And Hunt showed the maturity not to finish there. So he looked real good. He made me excited to watch him fight again, which is not the conversation I thought we were actually going to have here. I thought we may be talking about how great of a career Mark Hunt did have, and he's had a great one. But the consistent theme out of Mark Hunt's career is every time I think we wanted to write him off, see him go off in the sunset and eat a Big Mac with his son, he comes back riding backwards, and he's got on one hand a sword he's going to swing through every steroid user in the sport, and then I guess what, a bag of Big Macs as well in his other hand. I'm looking forward to whatever's next out of Mark Hunt. He's been an absolute delight to watch, and it's, again, astonishing for the amount of success he's had at his age. And if all those fights we just mentioned don't take place, another one I will look at is Mark Hunt against the winner of Volkov and Stephen Struve.
Yeah, that's definitely a good one to match up. But time-wise, if he wants to fight in September 23rd, that doesn't match up.
That's true.
But as I said, timing's everything in the sport. Now, another question we got from Brian Abraham was, what do we think about Derek Lewis eating a plate of ribs before the fight? Now, this is an image that it seems like it's been deleted from social media, but it happened to come across my timeline just because we were actually talking about this before we started recording this podcast, and it comes from Robert Follis's Instagram, which it's not there anymore, but it was a picture of essentially a selfie by Robert Follis, and in the background is Derek Lewis eating a plate of ribs and chicken an hour before his 5-round fight. I'm not a nutritionist, Daniel. I can't think that's a good idea.
Yeah, it definitely isn't. And again, I'm not so sure if this is a like legit or not. I think it is legit, because the only place on the internet I can find this is on viralpatient.com. But
which I've never heard of.
Which I've never heard of. I went to the website. It looks sketchy as hell. There's not much social media traction on it, but the screen grab they do have is like Robert Falls' Instagram, and it's detailed, and it has 90 likes, and it was posted an hour ago. So maybe it's true, and it could be true, because like if you just Google Derek Lewis ribs, there's a YouTube video of Derek Lewis's secret to proper BJJ training, and it's him grappling and then going and grabbing a plate of ribs. So I would not be shocked if this is true. I would say I am not up to speed on the like I'm not a Mike Dolce, you know. I'm not an expert, you know. I'm not promising to get Cyborg down to 135, and I don't have UFC fit. But I will say, Jason, ribs before a 5-round fight, bad idea, right? Yeah. And he didn't look great either, to be honest with you. I mean, he had his hands on his and some of that was probably his back, but he looked so gassed in that 4th round, which is surprising, because that's when I think of Derek Lewis, I don't actually think of him getting gassed at all. I mean, I think it was in the fight way before his UFC career when he fought Jared Roschott. He won that fight, I believe, because Roschott got gassed. He was wrestling him down, and then in the 3rd round, Lewis. That's how I remember that fight taking place. So
let's just 12 months from now, Derek Lewis retired?
No, no, absolutely not.
Is anyone going to say yes? Maybe besides Derek Lewis?
No, no, not even his wife. His wife's like, no, dude. I watch MMA. I know what happens. I don't believe you, Derek. But maybe he will be. I don't know.
The question is what is his financial situation away from MMA? You know, there was an article this week about Brent Schaub and on MMA Junkie, and it seems like Bellator trying to turn those wheels of like, hey, do you want to fight? But Brent Schaub, he's very successful away from fighting. He doesn't need to fight. He makes money with his podcast and his stand-up comedy and all that stuff going on. It makes you wonder is if Derek Lewis is very successful away from MMA, maybe he doesn't have the need to fight. But I think more times than not, fighters don't have that income outside of MMA, so pretty much they have to fight to pay the bills.
Yeah, and he exits the sport in a time where he has the firepower and the offense to finish just about anybody in the division. So it's hard. If I had bet my life on it, I would assume he comes back. I mean, how can I not say that when we saw Anthony Johnson retire, and not too long ago he tweeted out about him having the itch again, which is just like
less than 2 months later.
Yeah, so How on God's green earth can we say that Derek Lewis won't return when, again, he said probably in his interview, he's going to get married. So you must imagine, I've never been married, but I got to imagine, like, you got to be thinking about all kinds of things during that time period. Maybe having some type of change in your life feels necessary. But once it all settles and, you know, you're hanging out at the house, you know, turn on UFC, the itch happens. So, bottom line, I think he returns, and you know, when you see a fighter like Mark Hunt, who you know is 43 years old, how can you not get it? How can you not think that Derek Lewis will return to form as long as he, you know, maintains some type of fighting shape and maintains the power that he has in his hands?
Look, as a married man, and this week actually, me and my wife will celebrate 9 years of marriage. Wow. And I will say this, that everything goes through the wife. Every decision you make financially, you know, we're making together. So I am sure that is something that will sit down. I mean, you want to kind of, you know, look at what's going on with Tom Brady. You think Giselle is not sending the message in a public form that she wants him to retire?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Giselle's going to single-handedly bring down the NFL.
Well,
yeah.
Well, in their case, they don't need money. I think they. I'm pretty sure they're, you know, they're financially secure for the rest of their lives, their kids' lives, and probably their kids' kids' lives.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tom Brady is the trophy husband to Giselle, who is just. She's
I mean,
got
think about
so
that. He's the greatest quarterback in the NFL, and he's the trophy husband.
Yeah, man, it's crazy the power couple that is. Like. That's a global power couple, because I mean, like, look at her impact on the opening ceremonies of Brazil. She's such a huge star in Brazil, and I would assume South America and in America. Yeah, she's a champ, man. She really is. And yeah, poor Tom Brady, man. He really doesn't have anything going for him, does he?
Did you see they just had their ring ceremony this weekend? Did you see how many diamonds are in the ring?
Yeah, it's so gross.
Did you see the number, though?
How many? 50?
283.
283? Really? Is there something significant about that number, or was that
283?
Oh, Jesus. Yeah.
Obviously. I mean, that's just trolling if you're the Patriots, right?
What a bunch of jerks. What a bunch of jerks. And I saw that ring ceremony. I think Gucci Mane was there, who was like an Atlanta representative, a rapper. And anyways, poor guy. But geez, that is just brutal. I can't. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a funny video where Martellus Bennett puts up, you know, showing off his ring. He's got the one ring on, and Tom comes over with his five rings.
Yeah. Yeah.
If anyone hasn't seen, I know it's on Barstool Sports. If you want to check that out. But back to what happened here at UFC Fight Night 110, Derek Brunson. You know, this was one of those fights when we talked about in the preview podcast. It was kind of tough because it's tough to go against Dan Kelly, because it seems like every time you bet against this guy, he comes in. But Derek Brunson, you go back to that Robert Whittaker fight, and he was over aggressive, and you know, he talked about that this week, of the fact of he was chasing that title shot, and he felt that he had to do something dynamic to get that, and ultimately gets finished in that fight. Then he comes back at UFC 208, takes a short notice fight against Anderson Silva. He's more cautious, but ultimately it's a fight that a lot of people thought he won. Does not go his way, but you definitely saw a more calculated Derek Brunson waiting for that opportunity, and man, what a left hand he landed.
Yeah, man, if he continues to fight like this, the sky is the limit for a fighter like him with such a great finishing ability, and just he reminded us of what he did prior to some of those brutal losses, where it was just like, when Derek Brunson fights, you can expect that you should hold off on the whole restroom thing, like wait until the fight is over, because he's great. And yeah, I felt stupid for picking Dan Kelly almost immediately. I mean, the difference in size and the fact that it took just about one punch to win for Brunson was just you know, it was a reminder. And the run Dan Kelly went on up until this fight is just delightful, really fun. And Derek Brunson, I mean, he has no time for fun and games. He wants to fight Antonio Silva and Ryzen. So
Antonio Carlos Jr.
Yeah, but he called out Antonio Silva.
Yeah, which Brian Stan immediately corrected him on. But that's a fight that, I mean, he mentioned about it. He kind of wants to become the, I guess a new phrase now in UFC is you want to be the new cowboy. But if you're Derek Brunson, what does a fight against Antonio Carlos Jr. do for you besides a payday?
Not a lot, but you know, not everyone can get the big money fight, you know. And
I'm just thinking in terms of rankings. You should always be wanting to fight guys who are ranked above you, right?
Kind of, sorta. I don't know. So Antonio Carlos is not even on the rankings. Wow, that's shocking. Actually, I thought he would have been 15. Well, he certainly will be 15 because Dan Kelly was 15 heading into this one. So you're right. If he's been, you know. Well, I know he wanted Anderson Silva, but then Brian Stan kind of dispelled that before he even asked him. He's like, besides Anderson, who would you like? So the thing is, like, Antonio Carlos called out Brunson Kelly winner, and I think that was with the intention of fighting Dan Kelly maybe. So I think the fight makes sense. Maybe you want to bite off more than you can chew, but when you do that, Jason, you may not actually get the fight. But if you do it like this, I would just be shocked if we don't see Brunson versus Antonio Carlos. And it's one of those – it's also maybe smart, because for Brunson, he probably thinks he has a great chance of finishing that fight as well. So maybe in the long run, piecing together several first-round finishes is more valuable than challenging a guy above you and then going out there and losing.
And my guess is the UFC will probably grant his request, and they'll make that fight happen. I think in terms of rankings, I mean, obviously, when you look at in front of him, it's a who's who of this division. Maybe a fight against David Branch makes a lot of sense for him from a rankings aspect.
Yeah, yeah, but it's one that, oh, man, David Branch is almost a fighter you want to stay away from for any middleweight that has any type of momentum, because that fight could suck and be boring, and he could also lose to David Branch. Like, that Brunson-Branch fight goes one of two ways, in my opinion. One, Brunson gets a first-round finish, wins, or two, Branch has a boring performance and wins. Like, that is a high-risk matchup, but also a high reward if he dominates. So that fight would be more intriguing for him ranking-wise, but I actually would probably go with the Antonio Carlos fight. And this he he answered all the questions you needed, right? Like, he showcased levels of maturity that were gone in the Whittaker fight. And it's a reminder that one single performance like that won't ruin a career, because I remember the immediate questions we had after that Robert Whittaker fight was like, how does somebody bounce back from that performance where it's almost like it will ruin you mentally. Like, you'll almost be like a pitcher with the yips that just can't throw the ball anymore. Like a John Lester can't throw it to first base or whatever, because you bank your career off getting these first round dynamite finishes, dynamic, explosive, and then you go for it again and you get finished. But he didn't allow that to affect him mentally. And it's nice to see him become who he was prior, with just a big improvement in his striking defense. So I think Brunson's going to have a lot of success. He may run into big-time issues against top five middleweights, but otherwise wouldn't be surprised if he continues to win. I mean, so yeah, Brunson Branch, that's the one you want to see, Jason, that fight of the night contender?
I mean, I just think from a rankings perspective, it's a fight that makes the most sense.
What about Vitor?
Oh, man.
Sad, right?
I don't think it's a bad idea, though.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't see that being a bad idea.
Yeah, it is one where, gosh, that Vitor Marquardt fight was real rough to watch. And then if Vitor does get knocked out, that's another one that will bring a tear to your eye. Like, it's just, it's hard to see some of these 40-year-old, I don't know how old Vitor is anymore, but he seems 52. It's hard seeing these guys get finished. So you almost want to match them up against fighters that aren't known for their knockout power, but that could work. Man, I tell you what, though, I was just thinking of this. Like, we should have performance of the night. We have fight of the night. We should also do like a retirement of the night bonuses, because we're seeing these every single card.
I mean, Dan Kelly, you have to wonder what the future like is for him.
Mm-hmm.
Turns 40 in late October. You kind of wonder how much is left in that gas tank.
Yeah, it's almost like he had his run already, right? Like, that was awesome, the run he went on. It's hard to imagine that he will be able to top that moving forward, but maybe if he just loves the idea of competition, there are matchups available for him. And I don't know where you would even go next for Dan Kelly. Like, I wouldn't even begin to have a general idea. You would probably have to look outside of the top 15 for his next matchup, unless you're just being, you know, unless the idea is he's a setup opponent for an A-side fighter.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, we'll see what happens there with him. Dan Hooker, beautifully timed knee to end the night for Ross Pearson, and likely, I think that the days of Ross Pearson in the UFC are over if he does want to continue fighting. This is a fighter who has now lost four in a row, five of his last six fights. This is the first time he's been finished since the end of 2014, when he lost to Al Iaquinta versus a TKO. And prior to that, his last TKO stoppage was in June of 2012 against Cub Swanson. So, and Dan Hooker talked about it. This is something that they had saw in preparation for this, of knowing how seeing the tendencies of Ross Pearson. Man, just a beautifully placed knee there by Dan Hooker.
Great post-fight interview out of Dan Hooker. A lot of personality. Real fun fight. It was back and forth, which, again, would be a shame for Pearson to get cut, but it makes sense. Having lost four in a row, would not be surprised at all. It almost felt like this fight in itself was a branch that the UFC extended to Pearson to get another opportunity. So, unfortunate, but it was close until the finish and a brutal knee. The theater of it was just awesome, with the mouth piece flying out of the mouth of Ross Pearson. And then upon a rewatch, you can almost see it, where Ross twice before the knee would drop his head to the left, and he did it again. And the third time he did it, he got caught with the knee perfectly timed out of Dan Hooker. Dan Hooker is a guy who I'm always excited to watch fight, because he's just a really fun striker to watch compete, and great win out of him. Ross Pearson is... it's been a very long time since he's been finished. In fact, the last time he was against Al Iaquinta, as you mentioned, in 2014. Like, every other fight he's had, it just simply goes the distance. And the torch has been passed, Jason. And you know what I'm talking about. Dan Hooker, win-loss, 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 win-loss. He's the new Pearson.
Yeah, you know, and we'll see what happens with Ross Pearson and what lies ahead for him. Ian Kutalabe, a knockout win in 22 seconds against Enrique Da Silva. You know, I mean, obviously a tremendous performance by him, but probably the thing that sticks out to me about that fight is the fact of, as he's being introduced by the ring announcer, he is all up in Enrique Da Silva's face. It's like, you do realize the fight hasn't started yet, right?
Yeah, man. And they lived up to that intensity in the fight. It was all aggression all the time. I love Kutalaba. Kutalabe? Everything is hard to pronounce about this guy's name. Prior to this fight, I was like confident in Ian, but apparently it's like Eon or something like that. Anyways, this guy's awesome. And I love John Goodman, by the way. John Gooden, excuse me. He did a great job setting up the very opening moments of this fight, where he just used the two nicknames of this guy, of these guys, of Silva and Kutalabe, where it was like Hulk versus Frankenstein. And I just thought that was awesome. Yeah. And they fought like Hulk versus Frankenstein, dude. It was quick, it was fast, and bad striking defense out of Silva. Don't know what the approach was there, but I really enjoyed everything about this 22-second fight, including the post-fight interview where you know, Kutalabe said goodnight to his kids who were watching it, I guess, in America or maybe Moldova. Not sure, but love this one.
Yeah, a very exciting fight there for him. You mentioned about Alexander Volkanovski, the decision win over Risotto Hiroto. Vince Michel, knockout win over Damian Brown. You know, Vince Michel, first time fighting in 3 years. He talked leading into this fight about the fact of, you know, just kind of everything has gone wrong for him the past couple of years. And kind of saw this as, you know, literally as a UFC-type debut for him, big win for him. Luke Jamo gets a decision win over Dominic Steele. Zach Otto, split decision win over Kochi Kumamoto. And J.J. Aldrich gets a win over Chan Mi Jian. Should be noted that the matchup between Dong-Yong Kim and Theobald Goti was scratched just hours before this event due to an illness. And anytime I see that statement come out by the UFC, you know, day of the fight, guys out to illness, is it wrong me to automatically say, it was a tough weight cut and just the body just didn't react the way it needed to be ready to fight on fight night?
That has to be the assumption. It's much like the assumption we have whenever a guy retires and we assume that it's because we assume he'll return. And it's the same thing with this, where we see it constantly. And because so many of the times when there is an illness late to the event, it is tied to the weight cut. And because the weight cut is such a dramatic thing to do to your body, I'm sure sometimes when this takes place, it's not due to the weight cut, but more often than not, that's it. I mean, Derek Lewis talked about this back injury that he had headed into this fight, and he still continued to fight. So it has to be something dramatic and reactive, and the weight cut would make the most sense, and it's safe to assume that's what it was.
And, you know, so this fight card is in the books. The UFC heads to Singapore now for UFC Fight Night 111, Betch Kahaya versus Holly Holm. You know, to me, and we're going to get it on Wednesday's episode of the MMA Report podcast, Daniel's going to come on and we're going to preview this fight card. But for me, the top two of these two fights on this fight card, for me, are the two fights that are going to kick off the main card, both welterweight matchups, Tariq Saifuddin, Rafael Dos Anjos, Dong-Yong Kim, Colby Covington. I guess here's a question, and I want the listeners of this podcast to hit me up on social media, at Jason_Floyd. Look at that preliminary card. What fight is getting you to wake up early in the morning on Saturday morning? Fight card starts 4:30 a.m. Eastern hour with the preliminary card. I want to know, what is a fight that you say, I've got to get up to watch that fight live? It's just something that interests me of, is if you are a fan that you're going to get up, what is a fight that says, that's the why I'm getting up that early?
Obviously, Kwon Ho Kwok's bantamweight return. I mean, this is a guy I think could be the next champ. No, yeah, it's rough. It is a rough card to wake up to. We may do it. I don't know how big of a degenerate we are, but if you want my answer, it would have to be Alex Caceres. Mashed up against a fighter and that I have not done research on until I will know more about him when we do the preview part on the MMA Report on Wednesday. So Rolando Gabriel, would not be surprised if Alex Caceres, though, upon you know, my assumption is that he's going to come out and dominate and look good. So that's worth the watch. But to be completely real with you, wait until the fights are over, identify which ones were good, and then watch it at a normal hour.
I would say in terms of what interests me, I probably Justin Scoggins returned 125 pounds. What does he look like after the situation he had previously? I mean, Alex Sarris you mentioned, but you know, this is a fight card. I mean, look, I'm for the most part a pretty early riser. You know, typically I'm up between 5:30 and 6 o'clock every morning. If I happen to be up that early on next Saturday, I'll probably, you know, while I'm sitting here working in my office, I'll have it on one of the screens. But for the most part, I mean, I plan to watch the main card live. I would definitely say that I'd watch the main card live. But it comes to prelims, that would be definitely go back after the fights are over and go back and watch them.
Yeah, definitely. Takanori Gomi and John Tuck is a great main event for the prelim card. So I'm very interested in what the atmosphere is going to be like inside the venue there in Singapore. So I love the expansion internationally. I really do. I really enjoy watching these cards in different events. I think the last time it was in Singapore, it was the Safedin card or whatever. And it's been a couple of years since then. So would like to see what the reaction is to the main event as well. There are some good fights on the main card for sure. I mean, you mentioned them. Safedin and Dos Anjos is the one I personally am most looking forward to out of all four. But there are things to look forward to on the Singapore card. And, you know, a couple fight nights away, Jason, one pay-per-view away. And then eventually we'll get our delightful steak of the year, John Jones, Daniel Cormier. We're counting down the days for that one.
Yeah, it's you know, less than a month and a half away from that fight. But we'll have Daniel on the podcast on Wednesday to preview UFC Fight Night Singapore. That is going to wrap it up for this edition of the MMA Report post-fight podcast on Radio Influence. Head over to RadioInfluence.com to check out some of the new shows that we have up there from Crush Performance as he talks to a player who has been coming up through the MLB international ranks, looking to become the first African-born player to make it in the major leagues with the Pittsburgh Pirates. Also, if you're a Houston Astro fan, check out the Fabulous Sports Babe as she was joined by Cliff Saunders to talk about why the Astros are having such a great season. Also, new episodes of Tough Fight Live and Ian Beckles' Flavor in Your Ear. Of course, as I mentioned, I'll be back on Wednesday for the MMA Report podcast. Be sure to give me a follow on Twitter at Jason_Floyd. Follow Dale on Twitter at Dale Galvan DGG. If you're not already subscribing to this podcast, do that on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and Google Play.
This is a Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
You know, I want to talk about workplace violence, the signs to look for, how to protect yourself in these situations. Now, again, this guy had been fired in April. I think the sheriff's department said 2 years before this, they had to come out to this place. This guy was a suspect in apparently assaulting another employee. So workplace violence is very, very serious. Now, in this day and age, of course, a lot of buildings, a lot of companies have key card access, right? You have to swipe to get in the door. You may have to swipe to get in the elevator. You may have to swipe to get in another door, behind another door. There's those types of security measures in place. Now, the problem is that, of course, HR legally does not have the right to go around and tell each individual, hey, John Doe got fired, so if you see him, don't let him in the building. So some of the things that you can do, because you never know when someone has been let go from a job, right? It's very important. And I know your physical security guy always says this at work. Don't let anyone piggyback off you going through these secure doors. Meaning if you have to swipe your card, guess what? They have to swipe your card. And you may think it's silly. You may know Joe Blow and say, oh yeah, I know Joe Blow. He's been here for 5 years. And I went to lunch with him yesterday, and last week we were at the company function and blah, blah, blah. Well, you don't know if Joe Blow was just fired an hour or so before that, and Joe Blow has gone to his car, gone home to get a gun. So you have to be careful when dealing with people that you think you may know. If they are supposed to badge in, let them badge in. Don't let anyone walk behind you. You're not even the security guard, as far as I'm concerned. If they're supposed to badge in, make them badge in. Another thing, make sure you know all of your exits. At the first sound, the first sign of danger, try to get to that exit if you can. If you can't, try to look for a place you can hide that's not too visible to the person with the gun, because they're usually 99% of the time only shooting at what they see, right? They're not shooting up in the air. They're not shooting into the walls. They're not shooting into the floor. They're shooting at moving targets. So if you hide in a good spot where they can't see you, chances are you have a good opportunity for survival in this situation. It is really never a good opportunity to try to fight unless it's a last resort, someone that's armed with a gun. Believe you me, when I go to my day job, I know every hiding spot in that building. All four floors, if the stuff hits the fan, I know where I'm going. I don't carry my pistol to work all the time, and I stress all the time. There's a few times I do. But if stuff hits the fan, I know exactly where I'm going when it happens. If you see something, say something. What you may think is just a verbal confrontation between two employees or maybe a physical altercation. If you don't think someone should be there, if you don't think they're right, say it. The worst that can happen is the police or HR or somebody can come talk to them and they can clear them, or they can say, yeah, you're right. They don't need to be here. There's nothing wrong with you going to HR or calling the police yourself if you think there's danger, to say, hey, you may want to come check this person out.
Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and RadioInfluence.com.